This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast, and you're listening to The Lines Between Us. This morning, we're going to focus on a line we all live with, gender. Later in the show, we'll talk about gender roles at home. Right now, we're looking at gender in the workplace, a subject of discussion for decades, as Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski made clear on the floor of the Senate late last month.
In the mid-1960s, there was turmoil. Change was in the air, and Lyndon Johnson was laying the groundwork for the famous Civil Rights Act that would open the doors for minorities. But the very first bill that he introduced was to guarantee equal pay for equal work for women. He did that as the first bill because he thought that would be one of the easiest to pass. Well, 50 years later, we are still being redlined, sidelined, pink slipped because we fight for equal pay for equal work.
Senator Barbara Mikulski speaking on the Senate floor last month. In 2011, Maryland women made, on average, 88 cents for every dollar made by men. That's according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. The gap in Maryland is smaller than the national average, which is 77 cents for every dollar. Joining me now to discuss the pay gap and the forms of gender discrimination that exist in the workplace is Lisa Matz, Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the American Association of University Women. She joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And here in the studio is Mary Keating, an employment attorney based in Baltimore and the Employment Law Hotline Director for the Women's Law Center of Maryland. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Sheila.
Lisa, let's dig into these numbers. Do they account for women's choice of jobs? I mean, if men on average are choosing higher paying jobs, then it makes sense that there's a gap.
Well, you know, there are absolutely good reasons for the gap, things that reasonable people like you and I would say, yeah, that's a reason why someone should make less money than their counterparts. But when you do really sophisticated regression analysis, which AUW has done in several of our equal pay studies, you find out that even when you control for the things that make sense, how many hours you're working, what kind of degree you have, if you have kids or not, and of course, within that one, we could even argue if that makes sense, then, yes, the gap becomes smaller. But there's still a gap, and that portion of it, which usually tends to be around 7 or 8%, is unexplained. And the bad news about that is that we find that even in college graduates, 1 year out of college when they have the same major, they're in the same field, and 1 year out of college when arguably they should be at the most kind of egalitarian point in their lives, they've already started with a gap. And then for women, unfortunately, it's a gap that follows them throughout their careers and tends to grow, even though women are more likely to get a graduate degree.
And what about race? Does it show up in different racial groups?
It sure does. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to me because when you look at the gaps nationally, you certainly see a gap between white men and white women. And it's about the same as it is overall, about that 77-cent stat. But when you get to African-American men and women, they're at a 99% earnings ratio. In fact, African-American women are earning almost as much as African-American men. And then, truthfully, Hispanic women, Latinas, have, I think, the biggest gap between themselves and the men. And then lastly, when we talk about Asian Americans, interestingly enough, their gap is even smaller than white women and white men. So Asian women earn much more closely to what Asian men earn. And I think particularly for Maryland, when we're talking about the technological corridor, and we're talking about NIH and science and so forth, that there's a good reason for some of that.
Mary, the Women's Law Center hotline takes calls from women who may think that they have been the victims of discrimination in the workplace. Tell us about some of the calls. What kind of calls?
Well, we do take calls from anyone in Maryland. They can be women and men. I think that it's not quite 50%, but we hear from anybody in Maryland who wants to talk to our volunteer lawyers. What we hear a lot from women who have issues on the job related to pregnancy discrimination, for example, sometimes they know that or they suspect that there is a differential in their pay problems. A lot of times they're calling because they're fired and they think it's unfair. It runs quite a gamut.
You received a call from one young woman Shavon Omusanya, who says she was fired from her job in food services at a nursing home in Annapolis when she had a high-risk pregnancy.
My doctor had faxed a letter over to my boss stating that I couldn't lift anything over 20 pounds. And they informed me that they could not accommodate my restrictions. They still said, well, you know, working at a nursing home, there isn't really anything we can do for you. You have to be able to lift heavy objects. But I knew this wasn't true because there were a number of things that I could do. I suggested working in a cafe where you didn't have to lift anything heavy.
Can an employer legally do that?
Today, yes. The employer does not have to accommodate someone if the reason for the lifting restriction doesn't stray into what is considered a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the EEOC has indicated recently that it is going to take a sharp look at employers who deprive employees of potentially reasonable accommodations. If their pregnancy problems may result from gestational diabetes, for example, or something that's a disability. But there are lots of people who are pregnant and their doctors just don't want them to lift too much, and it's not really a disability. But there is a law that's before the Maryland General Assembly and is going to have hearings.
A bill at this point.
It's a bill at this point. And it's before the House and the Senate, and the hearings are coming up next Tuesday and the Tuesday following, that would, in fact, require employers of at least 15 employees to grant reasonable accommodations to pregnant workers.
That's Mary Keating, an employment law attorney based in Baltimore, here on Maryland Morning, The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. And also with us is Lisa Matz, Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the American Association of University Women. We're talking about gender discrimination in the workplace. I want to go back to the federal legislation. Lisa, when we heard from Senator Mikulski earlier, she was introducing the Paycheck Fairness Act. Here's something else she said.
And why we need the Paycheck Fairness Act is the fact that women continue to be discriminated against and economically harassed and economically punished if they even ask, how much do the guys get paid?
I got to say, this was news to me. Are women, Lisa, are women prohibited from talking about wages in the workplace?
Oh, in about 50% of American workplaces, employers have created personnel policies that say if you talk about, disclose, inquire about wages at work, you can be fired. And that's completely legal. There are some folks who are protected by collective bargaining agreements and so on and so forth that don't have those similar restrictions. But for more than half of working Americans, that's very much the case. And in fact, it was very much the case for Lilly Ledbetter. That famous situation, she didn't find out till about 19 years in, and it was because Goodyear told her very clearly that if she were to talk about wages at work, she'd be fired. So we really believe at AUW that one of the things that's really needed here is some transparency. And of course, we're not saying that you have to disclose your wages. We just think that, like Justice Louis Brandeis, you know, this can be the best disinfectant, right? Sunlight can be the best disinfectant. So that's one of the big provisions of the Paycheck Fairness Act, that you would not be able to retaliate against employees who either shared their wages at work, you know, talked about how much they made, or inquired of the employers about kind of wage practices.
Mary, have you had any situations in Maryland where this was an issue?
It certainly has come up, although I can't think of a specific example. I do want to say that I disagree in part with Lisa about the legality of it. Any employer who is covered by the National Labor Relations Act is not free to tell employees that they cannot talk about terms and conditions of employment at work. But that law is very little understood in the non-unionized sector. The law does apply to non-unionized employers. So we have the fact that very few people know that they have that right. And then we have the cultural problem where I think many of us were brought up to refrain from talking about money and specifically asking such personal questions as, what do you make?
I want to go back to, Lisa, to the pay discrepancies between men and women. If I understood you, you were saying that there's some kind of disparity in every racial demographic.
Yeah, there really is. And in every demographic, the men make more than the women. And so, you know, the age-old question of are we more racist or are we more sexist, we tend to see, as I said, that the men make more than women regardless of the racial category that we're looking at.
Could I assume that since the overall wage gap in Maryland is smaller than in most other states, that that would be true in these individual, in the smaller demographics also?
Yeah, most likely. I mean, one of the things that's going on with Maryland, of course, is that we're the third best in the country in terms of our wage gap. So Washington, D.C. has the smallest one, Vermont, and then Maryland. And, of course, Maryland very much benefits by the high-tech corridor and the D.C. suburbs because there are a lot of high-paid women in federal jobs, for instance. So the reality is there that Maryland is doing much better than the rest of the country, but the reality is that there's still a gap. No matter what we do, no matter how much we control, there's always a gap, and that's where we need legislation, because the Equal Pay Act has been law since 1963. That's almost 50. It'll be 50 years old in June, and the reality is it has not closed the loopholes as much as we need them to do. So this particular bill, Senator Mikulski's bill, the Paycheck Fairness Act, would not only deal with the non-retaliation provisions, but would put better deterrence in place to try and get employers to follow the law in the first place, would reinstitute some data gathering and compensation and data tools from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and at the Department of Labor, and also, quite frankly, would talk about salary negotiation in women so that perhaps we could start training women to talk a little bit more about how to do that proactively and effectively as one element of helping to close the gap. You can't negotiate your way to completely fair pay, but it is something that you can do on a personal level to try and help the situation.
Is there any breakdown of what the wage gap is like among gay and lesbian, transgender?
You know, that's not something that I have seen, quite frankly, although I do know anecdotally we work in coalition with the Human Rights Campaign and the Gay and Lesbian Task Force. And of course, one of the things that we see there is that lesbian partnerships struggle much more financially than gay men do. And they particularly have a huge issue when it comes to retirement. So I don't think it's a coincidence that some of the cases you see coming through the courts in terms of inquiring about access to partner benefits are coming from lesbian women, because they are really suffering financially given part of what's going on with the pay gap.
That's Lisa Matz, Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the American Association of University Women, here on The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me is Mary Keating, an employment law attorney who's based in Baltimore, and we're talking about gender discrimination in the workplace. On this question, let me ask both of you, on this question of the job choices that women make, if they choose to be teachers and social workers and our economy doesn't reward those jobs the way it rewards some jobs that are more, tend to be chosen by men. I mean, can we say that society is discriminating against women?
Mary? I think this is quite an octopus of a problem. Maybe it was 20 or 30 years ago when people were trying to talk about comparable worth and raise the ideas that various jobs that were undervalued ought to be more valued, and so forth. So that train's been stalled for quite a while. But there's more to it than that. Among the highest achieving and highest educated people, Catalyst has done a bunch of studies about how...
Catalyst is an organization
Catalyst is an organization that, from what I've seen, does a lot of studies about how women can thrive in the workplace. And they have done some recent studies about that show that women are given fewer high-profile jobs that would act as stepping stones to even better jobs, that they're given more routinized assignments. So among those people, women are not able to advance even in the same jobs as men.
But the question I have for both of you is, why would employers be doing this? I mean, businesses want to maximize profits. So what would be the incentive for employers to be holding women back? Let me ask Lisa.
I think part of what we're trying to deal with here are two different issues. One of them is the whole issue of pink-collar jobs and job segregation, which is certainly a part of the reason why we have the pay gap, right? It's one of the reasons why we know that if we can get women into more non-traditional jobs, they will make more money. But even in those non-traditional jobs, there's a pay gap. And so the reality is that we still know that women are being valued differently in the workplace. And some of this goes back to those stereotypes, those age-old stereotypes that, despite how far women have come, still seep into the decision-making process. And for women in the workplace, oftentimes decisions are made, for lack of a better way of putting it, based on our reproductive capacity. Do we have children? Are we going to have children soon? Are we going to be taking care of our parents? What's going on in our caregiving lives? And so many assumptions are made about, one, do we even want promotions because we might have to travel or we might have to work later? And two, would we be as reliable employees if we're the ones who are taking time off when the kids are sick or when, mother-in-law needs to go to the hospital. So at the end of the day, we've got these kind of competing issues that combine to really hurt women. But I think the pink collar job segregation is one that really gets me because, well, AEW does a lot of work to try and encourage women to get into non-traditional fields, particularly those in science and technology. At the end of the day, it's not like we don't want people to be teachers and social workers. We still need those. So we need to look at why those are valued differently. And that's where, as my colleague says, that the whole comparable worth issue comes in, where you try to look at these jobs and evaluate them in a way that is unbiased. So, for example, they did a comparable worth study on Long Island and found that they were paying their groundskeepers more than their first-year teachers. Clearly, there's a bias there. Clearly, there is some assumption there about the worth of that job, the worth of the person doing that job, and what they're willing to pay for it.
Mary?
Yes, I think that there are these meta biases that Lisa was just talking about, and they're holdovers from many generations of assumptions about who was bringing in the bread and what various jobs were worth. But in terms of the non-traditional jobs that are not highly skilled, I do hear from a lot of women who try to make inroads into jobs such as factories or truck driving, and they face an awful lot of harassment. So there's still something that can only be explained by gender discrimination. There are men who are their bosses, there are men who are their coworkers who seem not to want them there at all, to the point of sabotaging their work. And I hear from people who just can't take it anymore. So there is still a lot of work to do, both at the highest and the most poorly paid levels.
Thank you both for this conversation. Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
Lisa Matz is Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the American Association of University Women. Mary Keating is an employment law attorney based in Baltimore and the Employment Law Hotline Director for the Women's Law Center of Maryland. We have more information and more of this interview on our website, wypr.org. And we want to hear from listeners as well. Are you a man who's faced a tough situation with gender in the workplace? Or maybe you're an employer who's navigated a sticky situation. We want to hear from you. Call us at 410-881-3162. Again, that's 410-881-3162. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on The Lines Between Us, Tom Hall explores gender expectations in the household. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to The Lines Between Us, our year-long examination of inequality. On the first half of the show, we talked about equality in the workplace. Now, when it comes to dividing up the responsibilities of housework, are things equal in your household? If you're living with roommates or a significant other, do you have a system for deciding who does what chores? If you're married, you'd be the exception if you and your spouse have never argued about how much or how little you're each doing to keep the household running smoothly. And then there's the matter of taking care of the children. For men and women these days, the lines between us are not nearly as clear as they were once thought to be.
You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh. Well, that explains about Mom, but how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences. But us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking. Sort of a throwback to caveman days. Hand me those asbestos gloves, would you, Molly? Well, there's no sense in us cavemen burning our hands.
Well, the show may have been called Leave It to Beaver, but evidently an awful lot got left to Mrs. Cleaver. Thankfully, times have changed, and how we use our time has changed. Dr. Melissa Mielke and Dr. John P. Robinson are professors of sociology at the University of Maryland. They've studied how we use our time, including how we divide housework. Last year, they wrote an article in the journal Social Forces called Housework: Who Did, Does It, or Will Do It? And how much does it matter? Dr. Mielke joins us on the phone from College Park, and Dr. Robinson joins us from Berkeley, California. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks for your time. Dr. Mielke, what did you hope to find in your study? What were you looking to determine?
Well, John and I, along with our colleague Suzanne Bianchi, who's at UCLA now, and Leanna Sayer, who's just joined us at Maryland, have been looking at these issues for quite some time, and John may talk about his even longer experience, but we've been able to look from the 1960s now to the very present with the latest data that we've compiled here to examine really some dramatic changes that women and men have gone through over these decades in terms of how they're allocating their time in the home.
And what areas of housework did you look at specifically? What do you mean by the term housework?
We look at what we were calling core housework, which includes cooking meals, meal cleanup, house cleaning, laundry and ironing, and then other housework, which is outdoor chores, repairs, garden, animal care, bills, paying bills, and so on. We also then looked at child care, which is, you know, taking care of children in lots of different ways.
And so, Dr. Robinson, who's doing what? What are men doing and what are women doing, and how has that changed since the time of Leave It to Beaver?
Well, it's quite a dramatic change, actually. It's also something that I sort of refer to as a stalled revolution in the sense that not much has changed since about the mid-90s. It's hard to imagine going back to the 1960s and that at that time women were doing about 85% of the housework and about 80% of the child care. And that has really changed dramatically. From a ratio of about 6 or 7 to 1, men doing 1/7 or women doing 6 times as much as men, now to a point where it's more closer to a 2-to-1 ratio for both housework and for child care.
What about the importance of income and income level? Dr. Mielke, I mean, are there differences between people living on the upper ends of the economic strata as opposed to those living in the middle and the bottom?
Well, that's a great question. We're mainly comparing men and women in this paper, but we have looked at people's education level and how their time allocations are different across their status. You know, for example, one area is in childcare. So among married mothers, those with college degrees actually spend more time doing certain activities with children, for example. We also know that, you know, people who have resources can buy out of housework to some degree. They're paying other women essentially to do housework, and that's obviously stratified by class.
So, Dr. Robinson, can you summarize for us what the most significant changes have been since you began studying this in the 60s, and what has exactly leveled off in the 90s?
It's not just in terms of the basic household chores, but it's also there's been more of an equality of actually women increasing more the amount of time spent doing what used to be men's domain, like outdoor chores and the like. So it's just been a gradual bringing together, and actually something which actually goes beyond housework and childcare. We find in general that women's time and men's time, not just in work and family care, but in terms of personal care and free time activities, men's and women's times are becoming much more similar to each other.
Dr. John Robinson is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the director of the Americans' Use of Time Project. He's on the phone with us from Berkeley, California. Dr. Melissa Milkey is a professor of sociology and on the affiliate faculty of the Women's Studies Program at the University of Maryland College Park. On 88.1, it's The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Milkey, are attitudes changing? Is this is the fact that even though there's still some disparity between the amount of hours each gender is spending on housework, are the gender roles evolving?
So we saw a lot of dramatic change in attitudes about mothers working and who should do what, and that sort of again leveled off in the mid-90s in terms of a lot of change. So we saw a lot of change prior to that, and then now it's, you know, fairly stable. And so definitely massive change in attitudes as well. But in the, you know, recent decade and a half, things haven't changed as fast for sure.
Generally speaking, homes are bigger than they used to be in the 1960s, and our lives seem to be more complicated. Technology, which is supposed to help us organize ourselves, is oftentimes, you know, an extra albatross to bear when it comes to keeping up with this stuff. So do we have more to do, even though we may be doing less?
I thought you were going to ask me, you know, are our homes messier? And
that's,
you know,
sort of what I'm getting at. I mean,
yeah,
if they're bigger, and we're spending less time at it,
right,
then one would assume that means we're living.
Yeah,
in
and I think John and I suggested that in an earlier paper that we wrote, because houses have definitely, on average, increased in size. And, yeah, women's hours have massively declined in terms of housework time, and men's have gone up some. But altogether, it's less than it used to be, and the homes are bigger. So, yeah, and you know, things do seem more chaotic and maybe interrupted and fragmented than in the past, and the technology certainly may be adding to that.
What about satisfaction or dissatisfaction with spouses, when we talk about married couples, when it comes to household chores? Are you finding men more satisfied, equally satisfied, or less satisfied than they used to be 30 or 40 years ago with the quote-unquote jobs that their spouses are doing in the house, and vice versa? Are the women less or more satisfied with the men, if it seems like they are picking up the slack just a touch? Has that created, you know, a little less friction overall, statistically?
I haven't looked at that as much as the question of how wives feel about what husbands are doing. Surprising, the first time I tried to ask that question in a survey, the woman who was in charge of the field operations refused to ask a question, or the answer would be 100% that men were not doing enough housework. But it turned out at the time it was really only about just about 25% of women who were dissatisfied with the way with the amount of time their husband were doing housework. And it's been a while since we've asked the question, but we did ask it about 10 years ago, and the results were pretty much the same. And I was surprised when we asked follow-up questions about why women felt that way, that that there seemed to be a lot of understanding that had been reached between couples, that men were putting in their time more doing work. So sort of the traditional division seemed to be there, and that women were not, at least in the survey, willing to say that they were really dissatisfied.
I think a lot of it has to do, too, with the, you know, men are being compared to their father's generation, and so they look pretty good. So it's like, who is the comparison group? So, yeah, they're not maybe doing as much as objective observers would say is fair compared to their female partners.
Okay.
But compared to their dads, they look pretty good. So, you know, there's a little bit of leeway that they're given, perhaps.
That's right. Set the bar low enough, and you can make yourself shine in all sorts of ways.
That's right.
Now, I mean, Arlie Hochschild wrote a book, which you've referenced in your article, about 20 years ago. She wrote this book called The Second Shift, where she interviewed a lot of folks about, you know, fitting in all of the household chores on top of, you know, two-person careers in the households that had two folks. And she observed that a lot of folks come into marriage with sort of innate gender ideologies, thinking that that their lives are going to, in some respect, mirror the lives of their parents or their grandparents. Is that still the case 20 years hence, Dr. Milkey? I mean, are you finding women and men are changing their expectations of what they should expect from their partner and their spouse?
I think there's more selectivity in terms of marriage is put up on a pedestal. You know, we want to get married if it's going to be this great union, you know, and so there are a lot of expectations. I think the younger generation definitely expects more from men, and the women may be willing to put up with less than in the past. It is a new world, and you may not have partnerships formed if men aren't willing to step up to the plate. This is important to a lot of people because they realize that, you know, women want careers. They want a lot, and they need the men to be on board with also contributing in all the arenas.
Dr. Robinson, you've been studying this for a long time, since the 60s. Anything about this particular area, the area of housework, that has surprised you as you've done this research recently?
The real change that we've seen has really been in terms of the gender division of childcare. It's been quite a jump in the time that fathers are spending, and more so. I mean, because in terms of doing general housework, it's the case. I think that's really the stalled revolution. I think men really aren't getting on board in terms of doing much more. I think of it sort of as the football analogy of sort of in the red zone. The red zone, it's much harder to move, and things are much closer together. There are more turf battles that are involved individually. So it may be a while before we reach true equality in terms of doing housework and childcare.
Dr. John P. Robinson is professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the director of the Americans' Use of Time Project. Dr. Melissa Milkey is a professor of sociology and on the affiliate faculty of the Women's Studies Program at the University of Maryland College Park. Thanks to you both. We appreciate it. This is interesting stuff. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Lines Between Us. This hour, we've been talking about the role of gender in the workplace and in the household, and we want to hear your thoughts. What role do you notice gender playing in your workplace? And at home, how do you divide the labor? Who cooks? Who does the laundry? Who drives the kids to activities? Who handles the finances? Let us know. Come to linesbetweenus.org, click on the contact tab and tell us your story, or call our listener line at 410-881-3162. That's 410-881-3162. Leave us your name, tell us where you live, and leave us a callback number. That's it for us this morning. For Sheila, Nathan, and the entire Maryland Morning Team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.